try not to be real formal. Dale did mention that because we're going to be recording this, even though we're a small group, we should still use our microphones. So this is the July meeting of the Regional Advisory Working Group. And today's topic, I'm Ken Kirky, Planning Director with the Association of Area Governments, soon to be actually Planning Director for the Metropolitan Transportation Commission, beginning July 23rd. But today's topic brings together a couple of different pieces of work that ABAG has been doing for a long time. You folks are very familiar with the work on the Sustainable Community Strategy and the Regional Transportation Plan since the passage of SB 375. And I guess I'll just say that one of the things that has struck me as we've been working on the SCS is the way in which climate change and both mitigating how this region contributes to greenhouse gases and climate change, which is central to SB 375, is a big focus of work at the regional level, impacts local work, transportation, land use, many different stakeholder groups. It's really taken on a very significant life of its own in this region and nationally and globally. But I think the Bay Area is kind of on the cutting edge of a lot of the work and a lot of the considerations that are happening. One of the things that we're talking about now is for the update of Plan Bay Area, the SCS RTP, the next time around, that we'll need to deal with climate adaptation in a much more direct way, because unfortunately there are going to be issues like sea level rise and other things that are going to happen, and figuring out how the region adapts to the climate change that is going to occur, even if we significantly reduce greenhouse gas emissions, is something we're going to have to do. But while that conversation and all that work is moving forward, we have a reality in the Bay Area that we are a very seismically active part of the world. And what's sort of striking to me is Plan Bay Area is a long-range plan through 2040, and the best scientific information we have says that there is a very, very good chance that we're going to have a major earthquake, not Loma Prieta, but a larger earthquake in the nine counties during this time span. And yet, when topics of recovery planning come up, people tend to act as if it's something that might happen or is something to be nervous about or something they'd rather not think about, or I'm not sure exactly. But one of the things we're trying to do is to build upon work that ABAG's been doing literally for decades around earthquakes and hazards, partner with other entities, including SPUR, full disclosure, I'm a member of the board of directors of SPUR, and we have Sarah Karlinski, the deputy director of SPUR, here with us, and she's going to talk about a specific effort that SPUR is advancing, building upon a lot of good work that Lori Johnson, who is sort of the recovery planning consultant extraordinaire, and work they've been doing for the city and county of San Francisco that we think is a really good model for what needs to be happening regionally. Danielle Hutchings, who is our program coordinator for ABAG's Earthquake and Hazards Program, is steering an effort to really develop a regional resilience initiative, and there have been a series of workshops around the region. There'll be another coming up in October to look at issues of governance and decision-making post-recovery after a major event, most likely an earthquake, although it could be another type of event in this region. But today we really, our goal with bringing this to the ROG was to start to try to integrate this subject into long-range planning in the region. When we look at a land use pattern for the Bay Area moving forward, and we know that there's a fairly good chance that there's going to be an earthquake We think it's something that should be a part of the plan. It should be identified that over this time period, this is something that is likely to happen. We can't, of course, with any precision say this is exactly what is going to happen, but we want to start to integrate these planning pieces. So that's in part what today's topic is about. The last thing I'll mention before I turn it over to Sarah is that, and this may be something you folks are well aware of, but oftentimes when we have these discussions, there's a lot of confusion about what recovery is and what that topic actually means. Typically when people in this region, in my experience, talk about earthquakes, they talk about the event and the period immediately thereafter. So they talk about things like first aid and where folks are going to go immediately after an event, what will happen in terms of if, there's a major event on the Hayward Fault, for example, and it really impacts the flatlands of the East Bay, where will those people go? Where are the parks? Where are the schools? What if the schools are damaged, et cetera, et cetera? Recovery planning is much more about, and others here can give you much better, more detailed information about this, but it's essentially about the weeks and months and even years after a major event. And what I find useful in terms of framing what recovery is to think about New Orleans and Hurricane Katrina. Different event, but same sort of dynamic where a great but to a large extent relatively low-income city faced a major event. And there are all sorts of reasons why things failed and this and that, which were problematic. So there wasn't enough work done up front in terms of mitigation to protect that city from what needed, in terms of what needed to be done. That was part of what didn't happen. And recovery can be about mitigation up front to make sure the impacts are much less significant. But it's also planning for what's going to happen so that a city, a region, can get back up on its feet relatively quickly. And I think in the Bay Area, from everything I've seen, we're, on the one hand, pretty well positioned for the hours and even first days after an event. It's not perfect by any means, but a lot of work has gone into that. But as far as planning for how the region would get up off the ground up for a major event, we've got a lot of work to do. And there are certainly communities, cities, jurisdictions that are particularly vulnerable that are not well prepared at all. And the economic, social equity, environmental impacts of many communities not being prepared for an event like this would be quite devastating for the region. And I think the idea behind this type of planning is that once an event occurs, that we would have a plan in place, we would have done enough mitigation that the Bay Area could recover quickly, and we would see minimized losses in terms of health and fatalities, but also minimized losses in terms of our economy. And so with that, I will turn it over to Sarah, who's going to describe the work that SPUR has been doing related to the city of San Francisco and how that's being expanded out in terms of looking at land use issues regionally. ABAG is partnering with SPUR, and we'll take it from there.
Before we get started, I'd love to know which jurisdictions you guys are from. If you wouldn't mind just introducing yourselves, that would be great. Maybe just start here.
Steve Piasecki, Morgan Hill.
Great.
Diana Kina from Emeryville. Camille Tsao from SamTrans.
Great. Thank you. Thanks very much. And then do you know these folks over here?
I'm Dana Breckwald. I'm earthquake and hazard specialist at ABAG.
And I'm Danielle Hutchings. I'm the earthquake program coordinator at ABAG.
Great.
Who do we have up here? I apologize.
I should have asked. If people could just introduce themselves.
I'm Janice with Caltrans Control.
Ken Moyne, ABAG Control.
Joanna Bullock, ABAG Staff.
Sorry, where is ABAG?
Joanna Bullock,
ABAG.
Oh, great.
Cool.
Thank
What should?
Yeah, anybody wants to come to the table, just come on down. We'd love to have you. So I think what I'm going to do is just set the stage, tell you a little bit about SPUR's work to date and how this effort fits within the work that we've been doing, and then talk a little bit about the project itself, and Lori's going to get into some of the particulars of the project. So just by way of background, SPUR is, we're a public policy think tank. We do urban planning work. We do governance work. We have an office in San Francisco. We've recently opened an office in San Jose, and we're looking also to do potentially some work in Oakland. So we're focused on cities and helping cities and thinking about cities and city work. Maybe if you go to the next slide, please. Thank you. So we've been working on the overall topic of disaster planning for the last, I would say, 6 years now?
Yeah. 2006.
Yeah. Wow. So for a while. for a while. And when we first started thinking about this work, we realized we need to think about it in terms of time frame. We broke ourselves into three different groups. The first group looked at before the disaster, so that's all the hazard mitigation work, and I'm going to talk about that in a minute. But basically, the things that we can do now before the disaster, before the earthquake happens, will help us with our long-term recovery after the disaster. Then, of course, there's disaster response, the days and weeks following an earthquake or another type of disaster. And as Ken mentioned, there's a lot of work done in that particular area, and jurisdictions know how to think about that, and it's pretty well-trod territory. And then there's this very complicated world of planning for post-earthquake recovery, and that's months and years following the disaster. How are we going to rebuild after a major event? Next slide, please. So we did a number of reports focused. Many of them were focused on this area before the disaster, and what we tried to think about was hazard mitigation as it related to long-term recovery. What do we need to do right now to shore up our buildings and our lifelines so that we'll be able to recover in the long term? And so we published a series of reports outlining our thinking as it related to existing buildings, new buildings that will be constructed, and then also lifelines. Next slide, please. We also recently completed a major report on this concept of how do we make sure that our housing is safe enough so that people can live in their homes after an earthquake happens. And so what needs to happen? How do we need to think about that? How do we need to think about engineering standards related to that, to defining what it means for a house or a building to be safe enough to stay? And what policies need to be in place to support people staying within their homes, especially since for San Francisco in particular, there simply isn't enough emergency shelter capacity for people to just go and stay in shelters in any sort of long-term way. And so we wanted to prevent the type of hemorrhaging that took place in New Orleans and other jurisdictions. Next slide, please. We've also completed one report focused on this long-term recovery piece. It was actually one of the most complicated, most difficult policy reports I've ever worked on. It was related to transportation. And we spent a lot of time thinking about, okay, you know, what do we need to be doing right now vis-a-vis our transportation infrastructure to mitigate against future earthquakes? But, oh my gosh, we don't know actually which fault is going to blow and where this earthquake is actually going to occur. So we need to come up with a menu of different types of options to be thinking about in the medium and long term following a major disaster. And actually, I think some of that thinking about sort of time frame and menus of options that work in multiple different arenas is something that I think is going to flow into our next set of work on land use and recovery, which is really what we're here to talk to you about today. So next slide, please. As Ken mentioned, we know that we live in an earthquake-prone part of the world. Our entire region is potentially subject to major shaking. I think it's a 63% that a major earthquake is going to occur within the Bay Area in the next 30 years. We know this. We have scientists working on trying to think about what this means, but we know this is going to happen. The question is when, and so we need to think about how to prepare. Next slide, please. So in thinking about that, we came up with this concept of resilience, and I think resilience is sort of going the way of sustainability in the sense that it's become this sort of catch-all term for a number of different policies or ways of thinking. But the way that we think about resilience is how basically after an earthquake happens, is the city going to be able to get back on its feet again? Is the jurisdiction going to be able to recover quickly and well? So we defined seismic resilience as the ability of a city to contain the effects of earthquakes, carry out recovery activities in ways that minimize social disruption, and rebuild in ways that mitigate the effects of future earthquakes. And in defining resilience, we got a little bit more fine-grained. So we started thinking about, okay, what do we need to have happen in different time frames following a disaster? What needs to happen in the days and weeks following a disaster, and what needs to happen in the months and years following a disaster? Next slide, please. And so we came up with this little table that I think it's for San Francisco, but really many jurisdictions can make use of it. And the idea is that the shaded boxes are targets. So those are targets for how we want to be able to perform after a disaster. So you can see that we want our hospitals, our police and fire stations, our emergency operations centers to be ready to go immediately, to have to suffer no impact as a function of an earthquake. And then, you know, for certain types of utilities and roads and ports, we want them to be able to perform very well in hours after an earthquake can occur. And we also want 95% of our housing to be available for people to shelter in place. In other words, to be safe enough to stay. Basically, they can camp in it. It's safe enough they can camp in it after a disaster. And then the little X's are where we are, where we think we are right now. Again, just for San Francisco. So you can see, ooh, gosh, we need to do some work on our hospitals. I think everybody knows this. Yeah, we need to work on our housing. But this was a good organizing tool for us to think about the relationship between mitigation and long-term recovery. Next slide, please. And then lastly, this is a little hard to read from where you are, but we did a little bit of work trying to think about, okay, well, right now, on a neighborhood-by-neighborhood basis, how much of our housing stock is vulnerable? If we want 95% of our housing stock to be available for people to shelter in place, what percentages are there right now that's available? And you can see in areas like the Marina and the Richmond and others, due to a combination of the housing stock, the shape of the housing stock, and the vulnerability of the ground to liquefaction and others, we're going to have some areas with some problems, and that helps us think again about the mitigation side of things. Next slide, please. But what we're here today to talk about is really this long-term planning. So what I've been speaking to you about earlier was this issue of mitigation and what needs to be done to buildings and lifelines so that they can function well post-disaster. But again, we don't know what size of earthquake is coming. We don't know where it's going to occur. And there's a possibility that we're going to have to really be prepared to do some major planning work after disaster, be it, expediting permitting just to rebuild what we have right now or doing something much larger. And Lori's going to talk more about what this means and how we're thinking about it, and then we're hoping to have a conversation with all of you.
We had one person join us. We're just curious where people are from since it's so small, so if you mind introducing them.
I'm Nathan Landau. I work for AC Transit.
Thank you. Welcome, Nathan. So these two slides actually were images, one of San Francisco after the 1906 earthquake. I don't know if you know, but there was actually Daniel Burnham, very famous planner. Thank you. developed a plan in the aftermath of the earthquake that was never really implemented. There was a lot of controversy around it. But that plan included a lot of land use change that might have corrected some of the problems we find very annoying with San Francisco today, the offset street grid, wider boulevards to get through the city, a number of issues that would have made the city more fire safe. And there were a number of reasons why that plan was not implemented. I actually worked in New Orleans in doing the reconstruction plan after Katrina, and we faced some of the same challenges of questioning, were all parts of the city really safe enough for people to rebuild in? Some areas of the city are 20 feet below sea level. They're already prone to subsidence. They're prone to sea level rise as that happens. They're prone to regular flooding from rainstorms and other issues besides hurricanes. And we had a real challenge of trying to think about if there were areas that we could use the post-event an opportunity to actually relocate people out of some of the most vulnerable areas. A lot of complications as to why some of that didn't take place, but still the thinking is there. And over time, actually, the city is working to consolidate lots now and buy people out of some of the lowest lying areas and move people to higher ground. So some of the policy work we did in advance. But it's very difficult to have these discussions after an earthquake occurs or after a disaster occurs because people are so threatened by what's happened and all that they've lost. And some of the famous early researchers in this area of long-term recoveries said very early on that everybody has a plan for what they want to see after a disaster, and that's they want back what they had before. And the real challenge of recovery is that you'll never, ever get back exactly what you had before. There's always a loss, whether it be a photo album, if you're lucky, or some small memento, or, you know, your home, a family member, things that are much, much worse. So minimizing or helping, you know, one of the challenges and why I love being in this field as an urban planner is that you really have this opportunity to do change and make a better city. You also have to deal with that trade-off and that compromise and working people through what is also a grieving process in many ways. So it's an emotional side of planning, but it's also, I think, a very human part of urban planning where some of it can be quite antiseptic sometimes and 50,000-foot view. So what we've been talking about in this committee when are there sort of triggers of different size events that these issues of land use become problems? And we can look around the world and see where this has happened. We really don't have that many examples in the U.S. because we haven't had that many recent large earthquakes. But if you look at what's going on in Christchurch, New Zealand right now, they had very widespread liquefaction. The government is saying, with every aftershock, the liquefaction keeps liquefying, the houses keep sinking, and we will have the same problem in certain parts of the Bay Area. And so the government, which also funds an insurance program, is saying it's not worth it to us to repair these houses because we're just going to sustain more damage. We're going to be out that cost. So they're actually buying out over 10,000 houses. This is very similar to the policy we've adopted, pretty standard now, with our National Flood Insurance Program and buying out houses after flooding so we can reduce the repetitive loss. They're looking at that same concept in earthquake terminology, which is somewhat new and something that we're very interested in studying. Similarly, in Japan, after the earthquake and tsunami, the government's using an opportunity to set back from the coast, reduce the risk of sea level rise, ongoing coastal flooding, the vulnerability of some of their infrastructure that sits right on the coast and causes a lot of repetitive costs as they try to continue to buttress and protect that infrastructure. So there you have the earthquake and the tsunami providing that opportunity as well. So the first thing we wanted to look at is, for the most part, most events in most parts of our cities, even in the highest event, are going to probably fall in areas where you don't need to have substantial change. You will be basically, what we say, restoring what was lost. You won't go into the question of, should we change the land use? Should we reconfigure streets? Should we actually buy people out, relocate people away from this area? But there are going to be certain situations, certain size events, or certain amounts of damage where that alternative approach to thinking will come up. Either people themselves will do it, the market will do it, or a city will see it, or government at some level will see it in its best interest. So this is actually something from another project that we've been working on. Ken Topping, who's a well-known planner in this field, was planning director at Los Angeles before the Northridge earthquake, put a lot of their planning thinking into place that was very effective after that earthquake. He came up with this chart that we're borrowing right now for our project, which just sort of frames that issue, that you have in a low-impact event, you might have an individual site or neighborhood that might have a land use change, a reconstruction of a large scale where you want to do some different, do something different, or have to deal with the challenge of rebuilding that in this sort of time-compressed, high-stressed environment. And then there are going to be situations where that'll be a whole neighborhood or a whole part of the community, examples being downtown Santa Cruz, other places. And then you get into where what happens when we have similar problems across the entire region, where we're seeing the Bay margins in Fremont, in Union City, in Oakland, in San Francisco, all having the same problem. Is there some regional policy? How would you promote equity, you know, when people are seeing one city take one action, another city's taking another action? Is there a reason for us to come together? Or are there issues where transportation or other key pieces of infrastructure, utilities, et cetera, are going to be thinking more regionally, and so thus cities also need to be talking about their policy for rebuilding in relation to the regional thinking that these other providers are employing. So these are just some examples of that. The Marina District being sort of what we might call localized restoration, where really no substantial land use change took place. However, there were still real challenges for the city. The city decided to keep that area cordoned off for a very prolonged period of time while it came to terms with the building risks and understanding what the problem was. And it also used that as an opportunity to restore all the utilities, repave the streets, do everything in an organized way. And this is something they're challenged with right now in Christchurch, actually. They have a whole division called the Christchurch Infrastructure Rebuild Team, SCIRT. I forget what the S stands for. But SCIRT is doing nothing but trying to coordinate utility restoration across the city so it's done in an organized way. So you're not going in and tearing up the streets once to repair the pipes, then coming back, paving the streets, then tearing them up again to put the sewer system in or something else. That it all happens and it's designed to with the future in mind in what other policies the city's undertaking. So that's the sort of difference between a Marina District and something bigger. This is just another example from the Marina District. The Oakland firestorm, while land use didn't change substantially, there was discussion for a period of time that it might, that the streets might be widened, and that the density in that area might not be as great. In the end, the city stuck with the same footprint, but it did have to do a lot and come up with a new way approach to expediting permit processing, and getting people back in their homes quickly. So this is just an example of an old grocery store that was used as this expedited service center for a number of years. Vision Santa Cruz was a planning process that Santa Cruz took in rebuilding their downtown and their Pacific Garden Mall after the 1989 earthquake. That process was put in place after they realized they had substantial damage. Business owners came together, worked with the city, involved the community in thinking through what they needed downtown. They needed more parking. They needed more adequate transit into the area from the university. They needed certain kinds of new storefronts and new configurations that were more attractive to today's businesses and today's retail operations than the kind of facilities they had before. So a lot of that change came in the process, but the visioning process took a couple of years. So how do you make sure that that process can actually get up and running and the organization that has to implement that plan and manage that plan is actually staffed in a timely way and works effectively within your city? And this is Christchurch, which I've been referring to. It kind of fell off the radar because the Japanese tsunami happened right after the major earthquake of February. But they actually had their first earthquake in September of 2010, a 7.1. But it wasn't as close to the city. It was kind of like their Loma Prieta. So they did have substantial damage in the suburbs. Then they had an aftershock 6 months later of a 6.5, I believe. And that is what you're seeing right now, where the whole downtown essentially began to collapse. A lot of reinforced masonry looks almost identical from a sky view of Oakland, about the same number of high-rises, the same sort of mix of old masonry and 1920s, 1930s, 40s, 50s buildings up to present. They are now in the process of completely deconstructing their downtown. They've erred on the side of safety. They're concerned about most all the buildings. They also had a high volume of insurance availability, so property owners themselves are saying, I'm going to tear this building down. So they have a huge challenge of rebuilding and figuring out. They've actually set up an entirely new management organization that's being run by the national government to deal with this process, which has created a real stress for the city because it's essentially taken away the leadership of the city in thinking about its own destiny. And the same, in a sense, happened in Louisiana with New Orleans in the establishment of something called the Louisiana Recovery Authority. So New Orleans really lost control of a lot of policy that it wanted to implement for recovery. So those are the issues that we're actually thinking about, is how do you think about the planning process itself? What are some of the regulatory issues that we have? We've lost redevelopment. And I'll ask you some questions. We've lost some of the tools that are very critical to use for financing large-scale reconstruction. What are some other financing issues? There are going to be a variety of pots of money, including money from FEMA. Maybe we'll get money through Congress from the Community Development Block Grant Program, which many other big cities have gotten after disasters. But then we're also going to have a lot of gaps. We're not going to have the insurance that places like New Zealand have. So we're going to have a lot of unfunded recovery needs. There's also one of the things that we like to say is there are two currencies in recovery. The first one is money, but the second one is information. Information becomes incredibly powerful, and providing information to people that essentially you as local government are not going to have the responsibility of doing everything. You have to actually sort of provide the vision, the leadership, and sort of arm the army of recovery rebuilders, and information becomes really key. People need to get it in a timely way. They need to be able to give you back information. So we actually have that as another key issue of this group. And lastly, multiple hazards, kind of getting back to the issues I described before with New Orleans and flooding and subsidence and sea level rise and the tsunami also having many of those same things. We have many areas that, as Ken was referring to, or right along the margins. We're going to have to be dealing with climate adaptation in the next update of our plan. Could we use this disaster as an opportunity to deal with some of these areas that are problematic for multiple types of perils? So again, we're looking at these issues on different scales. So what do they mean at a site level, at a neighborhood level, at the city level, and at the regional level? That's this project. We have a small committee. The way SPUR works typically is it assembles a group of experts who volunteer to work with staff. I'm chairing this committee, and as Sarah and Ken mentioned, we've actually agreed to work together, ABAG's Resilience Initiative and the SPUR Initiative. They're actually funded by the same organization, the Urban Area Security Initiative, UAWASI, is giving funding to both groups. And so it's a great opportunity to bring together the regional thinking that's going on with the ABAG Resilience Initiative and the SPUR thinking, which is taking a regional view but comes from a very city-oriented perspective, people working at a city level. But our committee is actually, it does include people from across the region and experts in a variety of topics, redevelopment, disaster financing, information and GIS management post-disaster, and on and on. So these are some of the questions that we wanted to raise with you today and get your input. The first is sort of what are some of the key regulatory issues that should be considered by cities facing widespread and substantial damage? I mentioned like CEQA, expedited permitting. These are some of the challenges that we know of. We'd like to hear what your thoughts are. With the abolition of redevelopment, what options are there for cities to use to assemble parcels, finance infrastructure, and the repair of heavily damaged areas? So curious what you guys are thinking about. In Emeryville would be a great place to ask that question. We actually have the benefit of
Catherine Firpo.
Are there changes to certain regulations, laws, policies that you know of. We threw up CEQA and NEPA as examples that need to be made at the state and federal level to encourage recovery, things that you worry about that they're really slow or they're cumbersome right now when you do your normal business, thinking about that post-disaster environment, how might that change? And how should we deal with these areas of multiple hazards? Have you been thinking about that in your communities? I know the firm I used to work for was very involved with Morgan Hill about 20 years ago and thinking about hillside areas and the faulting and transfer of development rights. So there are a number of issues like that. Our hillside areas that are fire-prone and landslide-prone and basically our bay margins or coastal and riverine areas that are flooding and liquefaction prone are sort of the two, I think, classic Bay Area examples of multiple hazards. So these are a few of our questions. We're also interested in other questions that you have. That's a lot of what our committee is doing right now, is just going through and asking the questions. What are the questions at these different levels for these different issues, and which one should we address? Any more you want to add?
Just one other thing, just in case you were wondering. So what we're going to be doing is we're going to be assembling this into a report that hopefully will be useful to all jurisdictions throughout the Bay Area. It won't be just focused on San Francisco. It'll hopefully be, again, sort of a menu of different types of strategies that can be employed in different areas. And it'll be out at the beginning of 2013.
And also, there is one other question on here, which is, what are some of the issues that you feel are regional in nature and shouldn't be handled by the city? Something that ABAG was very interested in making sure that we asked. So when would there be sort of that, as I showed you, those different levels, what concerns you that you would want to potentially have some regional interaction or kick up an idea to a higher authority or not? Ken or Danielle?
Do you have anything to add?
Well, there's a question for each of you.
So we could write them down and, like, you could draw.
Yeah.
Just one thing that stood out to me in the PowerPoint presentation, I guess it's on, I don't know what number slide it is, but the slide that shows the city of San Francisco and the percent of housing units usable and unusable by neighborhood, it seems to me that, I mean, one of the things that's striking when I look at the map of the city that's interesting, and, you know, knowing a bit about the different neighborhoods, is that one thing that one could argue is perhaps kind of a good thing. You know, one would like all of the neighborhoods to have all of the housing units usable and so forth moving forward. But the fact that the generally lower income neighborhoods are not the highest percentage neighborhoods in terms of usable or unusable homes is probably a good thing. And I wonder, in terms of some of our work, you know, this is a region with many faults. It's hard to know which one is, it's impossible to know which one is going to go first. My understanding is that the Hayward is among the most vulnerable. Historically, it's due for a really big one. And given the neighborhoods likely to be impacted because of liquefaction or proximity to the fault or just proximity to the Hayward fault in general, to have an understanding of neighborhoods in the region in terms of this basic data and how it relates to communities of concern, which is a regional framework for lower-income communities and communities of color, would be very interesting. I mean, my general sense is that we have a lot of neighborhoods in the flatlands of the East Bay that are very, very vulnerable, just looking at the housing stock, and they're also in some cases, very low-income communities in jurisdictions that aren't particularly well-resourced. And it would seem at a regional level, really understanding, you know, having this map for the region could be hugely helpful in terms of being strategic about the places that are most vulnerable and where to invest resources.
No, that's a really good point. There's a couple of points I want to make on that map. One, that was actually, we spent how long? We had 5 interns working on it for summer, taking a very detailed engineering study that had been done for San Francisco called CAPS, Community Action Plan for Seismic Safety, that looked at the different building types and what their likely performance was. And then we took that data and actually went and worked on aggregating that and coming up with that information. What's important about that is you see something, you go, oh, 50% in the marina. Well, 50% of the housing will be damaged in the marina. That there are also more vulnerable structures, larger structures that will also be damaged. Your commercial district will be damaged, potentially private schools that haven't been retrofitted will be damaged, and all your infrastructure is going to be damaged in an area like that. So when you see numbers like even 25%, the habitability of that neighborhood is going to be very low. People are not going to want to live there if a quarter of the housing stock is severely damaged. So you're going to see greater numbers of displaced people than what you see when you look at a map like that.
Well, I'll follow up on that. It seemed like, from afar, one of the things that happened in New Orleans, let me step back. I mean, from what I know, property owners never want to change, and the only thing we got out of the Burnham Plan in 1906 was Telegraph Hill Boulevard, which is a cool thing. But in New Orleans, it seemed like at least there was a very strong perception that they, the city, the authority, whoever, wasn't just asking people to leave low-lying homes. It was asking people to leave, that they were being judged, you know, you're not a desired citizen because your race or your income or whatever. And I don't know that dynamic would be as rough as it was in New Orleans, but I could really, based on what Ken is saying, I could really see it playing out again after a major earthquake in the East Bay or the Bay Area or almost anywhere along the bayfront. I mean, the marina is kind of an exceptional neighborhood in being a high-income bayfront flatland neighborhood. We don't have too many of those. Mostly the bayfront neighborhoods, they're either commercial or they're low-income. So it seems like that's kind of a fundamental kind of frame that anything else, any of this, would have to fit into. How do you make people trust that you're not just trying to bulldoze their neighborhood or bring in higher income people or whatever?
Laura, do you want
to? No, just take some.
Oh, okay.
Take comments. I mean, was it a question or just a rhetorical question?
It's a comment. It can be a question if you want it to be.
Well, I'll just make a couple of comments. I think that there was definitely a class distinction in Katrina. One of the things that's not well understood is that I think over 30%, I think it's almost 40% of New Orleans residents actually didn't have cars. And so one of the challenges was really evacuating the entire city with people who really didn't have the means to self-evacuate. So there was the large evacuation that happened prior to the storm. Then there were more people of all different income groups who then evacuated as the flooding began. And then there was the group of people who actually had to be, you know, who you saw on TV showing up at the Superdome or at the convention center, and then eventually were the government had to evacuate them in a formal way. All those different income groups came back at different times in different ways as well. Wealthy people could stay away, go stay at their beach house in Mississippi while they repaired their house in New Orleans, or they could rent a house, an apartment in Baton Rouge, which was 60 miles away, and commute in and repair their house. The people who were evacuated were sort of the other extreme. There was no way to get them. There was no program to get them back. And many of them were in public housing, and when the government decided not to rebuild the public housing, they had nothing to come back to. So their vouchers were transferred for them to use in another community. So the issues are really complicated. But what I look at is that, you know, what I was trying to make of that point of seeing a neighborhood that's 50% damaged, the wealthy people in the marina are going to leave. They're not going to stay to live in that environment. There will be those people who are going to say, hey, I love being in downtown Emeryville because it's cool. And, you know, I work at Pixar, and so all my friends are here, so I'm willing to camp out for 6 months while my my building is rebuilt. But a lot of people are going to say, I can't live under those circumstances, and I have the means to leave. And the tipping in or tipping out is a big concern, and should be a big concern for cities. How do you keep your people there? Because businesses will get loans. They will try to get back in business quickly. But if they're a neighborhood-serving use and they don't have a neighborhood to serve too, they're going to basically face two disasters. They're going to have the first one, then they're going to get money, they're going to reinvest everything that they have in rebuilding, and then the second disaster is going to hit them when the community isn't there to support them. And that's the cycle of loss that then sort of sends some cities into a spiral downward or some neighborhoods into a spiral downward that you have to think about with recovery. So they're very complicated, you know, sort of issues of how people choose to, what we say, tip in or tip out of the recovery process and when.
Maybe a couple of comments I can jump in here. Did you want to go first? I'm go ahead. I'll wait.
I just wanted to mention what I think is really a secondary issue, but it will be an important issue after a disaster area, and that is historic preservation and policy and how we deal with that. It's two questions. It's access to the information to determine which buildings are and which buildings aren't, which are the highest level of historic resources for an area or a city or a region. And then resources to money. So I did volunteer for Katrina for the National Trust for a week. And what we did after was basically to go to different neighborhoods and document the impacts on historic buildings. We photographed them, talked with the owners, did reports. And then we came back to the National Trust in New Orleans and wrote up reports so that when money became available, the data was there. But still, this was after the disaster. It's something that probably, well, the impacts could be done before, but certainly there could be some documentation on buildings before and made easily accessible.
Great idea. Thank you.
A couple of comments. Back to Ken's comment about the map that you showed of the neighborhoods in San Francisco. I think there's a power in just information and getting it out to people and understanding that you live in a neighborhood where 50% of the houses will probably not survive a 7.0 earthquake. If you had that information Bay Area wide, you could start to focus on, okay, where are the likely problems going to be? And part of it is, as you point out in the marina, you know, people that have money are pretty much going to take care of themselves. Over time, and probably there's less of a risk in terms of those areas versus areas where there's a greater risk, and certainly having disclosure so that folks know when you're moving in. Having gone through New Orleans, I think New Orleans is just a fascinating study because I think you'd have to blast people out of that city. I mean, they just love it, and they'll go into the low-lying areas, they'll come back in, and that's all they have. They own the land that they have a deed to the land, and it's such an attractive place for them to live. So it's like, how do you deal with that? And I don't know how you deal with it other than documenting. In the case of Loma Prieta, well, how much recovery really happened? What was the condition before, and what was the condition after Loma Prieta? Because I live in Los Gatos. Los Gatos suffered quite a bit of damage, but again, wealthy area, and they were able to recover without probably, well, they got some redevelopment, but not much. So looking at what has happened after, I think one of the great things about Loma Prieta was the Embarcadero Freeway is gone, and even the Cypress structure, which were just colossal mistakes in the beginning. And we have to kind of look at those things and say, well, you know, long-term planning, they probably shouldn't be there anyway. And trying to have a conversation and convince people of that is a difficult thing, but a worthy thing to pursue. I heard a couple of comments about, well, maybe we need wider boulevards in various areas. That concerns me because the whole SCS concept is less asphalt, less streets, more intimate neighborhoods and communities. So I don't know how you reconcile that. So looking for examples in the world, I think that's another great thing to look at because New Zealand is incredible. It's happening there. And certainly Katrina and Loma Prieta. We've got a lot of examples, and we can probably not model, but maybe attempt to model what might happen in the Bay Area and where areas of that are particularly vulnerable would be. And hopefully things have gotten a little better with the rebuilding from post Loma Prieta.
Yeah, I just wanted to say a couple things. I really, really appreciate your comment. And, you know, one of the things that we're thinking about, or one of the things that I think we're going to be trying to support, is that a lot of that planning work, you know, just is basically good planning work. And so when you're talking about the Embarcadero coming down, or thinking about what to do about the Central Freeway in San Francisco, you know, those are things that can be... and also how do you make streets that support compact communities and are walkable and nice? All of that is thinking that we can be doing right now. And you know, one of the things that I think we're going to be encouraging jurisdictions to do is try to do some of that sort of long range planning and updating some of their long range plans right now, so that the blueprint for what gets rebuilt afterward is already being done now, and the vision hopefully is agreed upon. There'll always be some, you know, piece of infrastructure potentially, or, you know, some neighborhood that might need some replanning after a major earthquake. But a lot of the work can be done ahead of time. So, for example, in San Francisco, we've just recently rezoned our entire eastern neighborhoods and some other areas that we know growth is going to occur. And so there's a community vision that's agreed upon by a variety of stakeholders for what should be built or rebuilt, so should an earthquake occur. But if that planning work hasn't been done, and I don't know the New Orleans example as well as Lori does, but there hadn't been a lot of sort of long-range planning being done in advance. There was very little sort of planning capability in that city, and that really came home to roost after the disaster.
Hi. So my comment is more on the site level, dealing with mitigation and seismic retrofitting of, say, houses that would not survive an earthquake. So I believe that, at least in Alameda County, I don't know about others, when you purchase a home, you pay a percentage of the purchase price is part of a transfer tax, right? And you have a period of time in which you can recoup some of that transfer tax if you apply it to some sort of seismic.
I don't know who the city of Berkeley.
Oh, only the city of Berkeley. Yeah. And
that's a great idea.
Yeah, I think there should be more of that to incentivize homeowners to retrofit buildings. But also the issue is, I mean, sometimes the cost of a retrofit project, let's say putting up shear panels or whatever, is way, way above the little percentage you're going to get back of your transfer tax. So people are still foregoing that opportunity to retrofit their homes, and I'm sure the county needs the money for something else, but it seems like it'd be a great way to sort of pool those resources for seismic retrofit projects. 'Cause I just know from, you know, personal experience, you know, being a condo owner with very few units in a building, you know, each of us would only get just a little bit back from that transfer money, and you don't end up doing it, and the time period expires, and units don't sell that quickly, and so there's all these opportunities being missed. And, you know, seismic insurance, earthquake insurance, I mean, sometimes the amount you're paying for years is just not going to really help you in the case of a disaster. So just a comment. I think there needs to be more incentives like the ones in the city of Berkeley, and a way to kind of pool those resources so that you can actually do a project that it's more realistic, more affordable.
I was just going to second your comment that the City of Berkeley program works really well, and of course the city uses that transfer tax money, but the great thing about the program was that the transfer taxes were actually raised by approximately the percentage that you rebate. So you're funding it yourself through your mortgage, but you end up, you can take that money back. You can recover that money if you use it for a retrofit. So I think it's a really effective program that it would be great to see other cities doing. And the insurance issue is just a phenomenally unprecedented issue. The level of insurance coverage that Bay Area homeowners have is less than 10%. And in other, even in any other major earthquake in the Bay Area, that wasn't the case. There was significantly higher insurance coverage. It wasn't until after the Northridge earthquake where insurance companies decided to leave the earthquake insurance business that insurance rates really dropped. It became too expensive to get earthquake coverage, and there hasn't been a major earthquake in California since then. And then in for other major disasters, hurricanes and floods, there's significant insurance coverage. So I think that, the loss of insurance or the inability of homeowners to have some recourse for rebuilding their homes is an unprecedented problem that we'll face in a future Bay Area earthquake.
I think we've got too many mics on right now. No, it's okay. It just occurred to me, Danielle, as you were talking about the insurance issue, which is obviously a huge issue, that, you know, in terms of private development, in the event of a major earthquake, most of it's not covered. Most of the losses are not covered, which is actually, you know, New Orleans faced lots of challenges related to politics and policy and history, and that it is a pretty significantly impoverished city. My significant other is born and raised there, so I know it pretty well. But it would seem to me that, you know, insurance providers provide insurance when the risk factors are such that over time they can make money. It is ultimately about making money by providing some protection. And if they essentially did the assessment and said, we're getting out of California because we know these earthquakes are going to happen and we're going to lose our shirts, I mean, in many respects, it tells us what we're up against, not just that we don't have insurance, but the insurance providers didn't think it was worth trying to cover because they knew one major event in one of our massive metropolitan regions could take them down, arguably. Just the amount of payout they would have to do was so large that they decided this wasn't a business we want to be in. And I guess, to me, it's just another sign of how important this issue is, that the insurance market walked away from it. The other thing, not too closely related, but thinking about how recovery issues can be better integrated with some of the other regional work, one of the major issues that's emerged in the development of the SCS, and it's been discussed a number of times here at the working group, is the potential issue of displacement. As infill takes up the majority of the region's growth in the plan, and priority development areas and so forth, a number of the social equity groups have really identified this as a major issue of making sure that, to the extent possible, existing residents, long-time residents and communities that are taking on new investment are not displaced, and that existing businesses are not displaced. And it's a complicated issue. I don't think we have a really good handle on the complexity, and that's one of the reasons it's a part of work related to the HUD grant that MTC and ABAG received funding for, to really better understand displacement, what the vulnerabilities are in the region, what kinds of policies should be put in place for jurisdictions to really try to forestall displacement to the extent possible. It occurs to me, again, if you look at the region and the places that are most vulnerable to a major event, particularly on the Hayward Fault, one major event could displace more people, whole communities. You know, in the East Bay, the African-American community is potentially very vulnerable in terms of displacement from a lot of flatland neighborhoods where, you know, these communities have existed for decades. But you're largely talking about low-income communities in rental housing stock that is not retrofitted. And the change for this, the city of Oakland, the city of Hayward, city of San Leandro, Richmond, et cetera, could just be profound and very much in keeping with what happened in New Orleans. And, you know, I think it's an issue that there's a real connecting point there, and it's something that we should be trying to connect up related to work that goes on with the HUD grant. It's a really significant point, and I don't really see the connection being made to a large extent.
Okay. Yeah, I'd like to go back to the SCS and relating this to that. It feels a little bit like a retrospective plug-in, largely what we're talking about, in the sense that most of this stuff you're talking about needs to be done today, now. Doesn't matter what happens in the SCS process, we have to do this today or tomorrow. So I want to see how we can relate it to the process. I mean, earthquakes strike me in the Bay Area. They could be anywhere. You really can't say one area is fantastically more vulnerable than another. I mean, Ken has brought up the East Bay flatlands, but I don't think anyone would suggest that we abandon the flatlands. I mean, it's plugged into the system. It's a high-density area. It's an area we want to make more dense in the process. Yes, we've got to look to these issues. I mean, no two ways about that. But I don't see there's a connection here. With sea level rise, I see a much stronger relationship because you actually take areas out of the equation. You know, you don't want to have a PDA in an area that you think is going to be flooded in 50 years' time. So there's a much more strong relationship. The earthquakes, you know, we really can't predict that anywhere will not get an earthquake, have major, major damage. Each time we have an earthquake, we discover a new dynamic in the way they work. And liquefaction doesn't always happen. I'll try to think of some example where this earthquake process would have effect on the SCS. And this is a narrow one because I'm a transportation planner, is the ferries. We have implemented a ferry policy in the Bay Area, which ostensibly, at least, is based on emergency recovery if we lose the BART tubes and the bridges. That has a very strong relationship because, obviously, if we have a ferry system and then we can build around that ferry system under the SCS principles, there's a direct link to that. I mean, people point out how expensive the ferry system is, so you could argue that it's there as a backup. But we can build into that system and maximize its benefit. So that's why I see a very strong link. Maybe I'm a bit transport orientated here, but I think most of this stuff I'm hearing is largely to do with, yes, we have to do it. We need safe places. We need houses that are retrofitted. I don't think we're thinking of saying, like, three stories is the maximum or anything like that. That would be quite radical. So, I'm a little bit confused today about quite how this plugs into what we've been doing before.
Well, I think there are a couple of things. One, I mean, you raise a really good point in terms of, you know, if one looks at a map of the Bay Area in terms of seismic risk, which is something we actually did when the focus working group was kicking off and looking at where should development be concentrated and what areas should be protected in the Bay Area. And essentially, the group that came up with the basic framework for the priority development areas, and one of the 400 different data points that group worked through was, you know, issues of vulnerability, including seismic vulnerability. And looking at that map, it was pretty clear, well, we're not going to – the region is very vulnerable. And, you know, if you look at a map of liquefaction, the financial district sits in a liquefaction zone, at least a portion of it does. I think the conversation is generally less about retreat from certain areas, but how do you prepare our region, how do you prepare the housing stock in terms of resiliency and mitigation up front, and how do you have a plan in place to carry out plans after an event. And there are big stretches of the region. You know, it's interesting to compare transportation and land use. In terms of transportation, I think somewhat akin to what has been done relative to planning for the hours and first days after an event. A lot of work has been done. I mean, you know, the commission has invested tons of money. There's this new bridge over here being built, for example, into, you know, hardening the region's transportation infrastructure. As I understand it, there are at least a few big gaps, including the BART tube going out toward Walnut Creek. But a lot of work has been done on that front. You know, it's a huge project along 880 right now. Doyle Drive was completed. A lot of the remaining major risk areas have been addressed. If you compare that to land use and development, again, it's like night and day. And we have thousands and thousands of people living in housing units that are not retrofitted, many of them low income, and many of them in areas that are priority development areas, places that, you know, different cities say they want growth to occur. Well, if we look at the life of this plan and we say this is the growth pattern, and we know there's a pretty good chance that an earthquake is going to impact some of these areas in the meantime, I think there is a nexus there that we need to make. We need to at least recognize that there's a pretty good likelihood that in the life of the plan, a bunch of the existing housing in some of these priority development areas is going to disappear, and it's going to be replaced by something else, and it's going to happen quickly, and jurisdictions are going to need to be in a position to do something about it. And I think at this point in time, it's just something, in my view, that just isn't on the radar screen in the way that it needs to be.
I'll just make a comment. I think that you make a really good point about the connection with the SCS, and I think that's something that we need to continue to think about. I wanted to make one distinction and one comment is that all of the Bay Area, or large quantities of it, are subject to strong earthquake shaking. But the earthquake shaking in and of itself is not a land use problem. We can engineer buildings that can withstand strong shaking. The land use problem is really around specific sections of the Bay Area that are vulnerable to liquefaction or landslides or surface faulting hazards. And that's a much smaller portion of the Bay Area. And I think a large portion of what SPURS project is looking at is that portion which is a land use hazard. The rest of it we can deal with in large parts through good engineering and good building code standards. And then my initial thoughts about the connections with SCS is that Sarah mentioned cities having long-range plans that serve as visions for how a city might look in the long term, and that can serve as your kind of visioning for recovery planning. I see the SCS as our Bay Area's vision. I mean, we call it our Bay Area's vision, and that could serve as our vision for rebuilding, and that the PDAs are areas that we want to continue to build in, and there may be damage to housing, but it may also be an opportunity for us to build those areas the way that we really want them to be post-disaster. So it's just one of my thoughts.
I want to make a clarification. Sure. It's very hard to talk about recovery without talking about mitigation. And there are places that will have substantial rebuilding challenges that we won't mitigate in time. Our existing building stock in the Bay Area is the oldest west of the Mississippi. And all jurisdictions, as nice as it would be to do what Berkeley's done, most cities have not. And in San Francisco, the map you see represents primarily the soft story buildings that we know, we saw them collapse in Loma Prieta, we know they're going to collapse, and we still can't. We've tried one ballot, we came very close, we got 63%, we needed 66% to get at least the affordable soft story structures retrofitted with funds, and we couldn't get that passed. So we have a substantial challenge in the Bay Area to deal with our existing building stock, not just residential, but a lot of small neighborhood serving commercial are in retrofitted buildings that will withstand the earthquake and not collapse on top of individuals, but they will still be rendered unusable. And so will many other 1950s and 1960s concrete style buildings. They will be unusable. Or the other point I want to make about insurance is that while the residential take up with the establishment of the California Earthquake Authority and the policy being not very desirable, the terms essentially are not very desirable terms. That's why people don't like it. but the commercial cover for downtown San Francisco, the penetration of the insurance market is very high. Most of those buildings are insured. And the problem that you will see in many neighborhoods is that we will have areas where people have no money to rebuild, and it'll be a whole neighborhood, so people will move away. They will choose to leave. They can go make that investment someplace else and get on with their life rather than staying and rebuilding that neighborhood. And those are people with money or people without money. We will have large areas of existing stock that aren't just because they're vulnerable land use problems. It's because the buildings will collapse, and they're common building types, so they will collapse in large proportions in an area. So you'll have a concentration of damage. In other areas where you might have good insurance coverage, you will have, in many cases, business areas where businesses choose to leave. They were marginal to begin with. It's an opportunity to close that family business, or an insurance company will pay out substantially, and the property owner will say, hey, I want to get out of this market. It's an opportunity for me to go build something different. You will have land use changes after a major disaster that are not necessarily, you know, the actual ground failure problems themselves. So that's where, you know, the conversation about what kind of planning processes do we need, what kinds of ways do we need to expedite certain regulations so that we can do this quickly, how can we treat things like historic preservation, make sure that the people, the character, the social and cultural character of our communities aren't ravaged by this event, are some of the issues that this committee is trying to take on.
I wanted to, as you're talking about engineering buildings, I wanted to mention an issue that's not, it's a regulatory issue, not land use, but the building code. I have heard the building official from San Francisco speak several times about the current building code for new construction, and that, again, the seismic standards are really set at a minimum so that people can get out of buildings, but that most likely, even new buildings, a lot of them would not be reusable. So I think looking at the building code and those thresholds for new construction is an important way to create some spots that will be able to be reused and shelter in place.
Okay, to your questions up here, third bullet down, we can link the SCS and post-disaster recovery by getting CEQA out of urban areas. One of the biggest things that developers rely on is time and certainty, and if the priority development areas and urban areas were exempted in some fashion, I'm not saying you would ignore everything, but the idea that you have to do an EIR on a relatively small project in an urban area is ludicrous. And then you've got the Air Resources Board coming down and saying, well, if there's a freeway nearby and trucks go down that freeway, that you can't have urban development near that freeway. Another major impediment to implementing the SCS kind of planning that we're looking at. Again, it doesn't mean that you ignore everything, but certainly trying to urbanize the priority development areas helps to offset the pressure on the suburban areas and the sprawl that has characterized our area. Without redevelopment, it is going to be incredibly more difficult to rebuild. You can't assemble parcels. You must compensate. You don't have the money to compensate. I don't think we have the answer to that question yet. Some backfill needs to occur. Dealing with areas susceptible to multiple hazards, again, starting the conversation early. Again, you go back to New Orleans, they know they're below sea level. They didn't move. when you have the big seawall up next to behind your house, and you still say, oh, no, everything's fine. That's what I was saying. You'd almost have to dynamite people out of those locations. And, again, I don't know what you do with that. So sea level rise here, I would think you might have a pressure to start building seawalls and protecting the private property. So I think we can kind of look for that. The first bullet about key regulatory issues, most communities are pretty quick to enact ordinances to say you can rebuild what you had post-disaster. You could set that up ahead of time so that cities are prepared to do that, but anyway.
About CEQA, I just wanted to say that we use the urban infill exemption a lot where I work, and we have, in our new general plan, we don't believe in LOS anymore. So that makes things easier in the CEQA realm. I guess the Air Board is still in court about their CEQA guidelines, so we'll see what happens with that. But and I don't know what it costs to do the kind of mitigations that it would take to build near the freeways with the HEPA filters and all that, but it's not that you can't build there. It might be cost prohibitive. I haven't found that out.
I think other people are probably more qualified to speak on the Air Board's CEQA issues, but I know when we were trying to figure out, well, gee, what constitutes a mitigation that the Air Board would find appropriate, it was actually very hard to figure out what those things might be, because when we were looking, and San Francisco has its own kind of internal set of regulations around what you're required to do if you build close to the freeway, and you know, they have, you know, you may have to filter the air or do Z-ducts, et cetera, et cetera. And so we were asking them, well, would that constitute an effective, you know, an appropriate mitigation? And they were like, sometimes, you know, or like, okay, well, it was very difficult to figure out what actually would be an appropriate mitigation and what would not. I don't know, maybe you've had more luck. Yeah. I don't think.
Well, one thing you said that was worrisome is that in a couple of in New Orleans and then in I think it was Christchurch, the feds came in and took over. So is that something we need to worry about here?
Yes.
I guess there's not much more we can say about it.
Yeah. No, I think that is something that we need to worry about. And one of the reasons that we wanted to take on this project is to help jurisdictions think about what they need to have in place and so that they can set their own vision for what they want their city to be and what they want it to look like. And so, you know, there's some discussion earlier about, okay, well, what can the region do? If we have a major event, there's going to be probably like one big congressional ask for funding. And so to the extent that jurisdictions know what they want to rebuild, can understand what damage they have, and are able to get that information together in a relatively rapid fashion, then we'll be able to coordinate better what we're asking for and also take charge of our own rebuilding.
When lacking residential insurance cover, most likely our congressional delegation will go to Congress and ask for a post-disaster CDBG grant. There are provisions in the Community Development Block Act that allow for large grants post-disaster related. That's what happened in the Northridge earthquake, and the money was given directly to the city of LA to repair soft story, tuck under garage, apartment buildings that collapsed, the Northridge Meadows being the most famous, where a number of people were killed. And there were large concentrations of them, whole cul-de-sacs, you know, so they called them ghost towns, and I think there were 17 or so around L.A. But that money went directly from the feds, a pass-through or recognition at a state level, but really directly to the city. I worked in a very small city, Grand Forks, that also got a post-disaster CDBG grant directly to the city. When Katrina happened, and New York got post-9/11 some CDBG money directly to the city. But when Katrina happened, the feds had a very negative relationship with the city of New Orleans. Their housing authority was in receivership, had been taken over by HUD. There was also just in general, you know, a reputation of New Orleans being corrupt. There was no way the feds were going to give the amount of money that was going to be allocated through the CDBG process directly to the city. And so the Louisiana Recovery Authority was set up initially just to advise the governor on policy about rebuilding, to make sure there was equity, because Katrina was not just a New Orleans event. It happened, it affected all of Southeast Louisiana. So there was initially an effort to create a stronger governance structure at the state level. But when this block grant came through, it became a great opportunity for the feds to give it to a different institution that would then set policy as to how it was directed. So when I said that New Orleans lost control of its recovery, that's really what I meant, because the block grant went to the state, not to the city. So it didn't have the money to actually begin to say, hey, we're not going to repair houses in this area. We're not going to turn back on infrastructure in this area. That's exactly what Christchurch is choosing to do. It's saying, well, the national government is choosing to do. It's saying there are areas that flood a lot, that are already at sea level or below, that face, you know, significant risk from sea level rise, which they're already experiencing dramatically in New Zealand. And we're going to go ahead and take those out of commission now. And what's interesting, I'm actually working on a research project now that compares all these different management organizations that get created after these large-scale disasters around the world, because we really don't know, is there a pattern? Why did they get created? What did they do? What were they set out to do? But then what did they eventually do? And how is that different? Because they become bureaucracies in themselves. Typically, they're set up to actually expedite, but they actually become bureaucracies. And slow things down with time. So that's one of the things we're looking at. So in Christchurch, what's really fascinating related to the SCS, as a short story, is that if anybody is a planner, you know that New Zealand actually tried something like the SCS. They have this urban growth boundary thing, kind of like Oregon. And the first urban area, Auckland was sort of exempted because it was so big and so urbanized. So the first urban area to really sort of deal with the urban growth boundary issue was the Christchurch Canterbury region. And they were fighting as the city and the suburbs for about a decade. And heads rolled, you know, careers were won and lost around this urban growth. They call it the UDS, Urban Development Strategy, around this boundary. And because of that, the national government really lost faith in Christchurch's government because of their bad behavior in the region. And under their national policy, the regional government would have become the leader of recovery. That's how their system is set up. But because they had taken over control of the regional government because of the problems with getting the UDS passed, they had actually thrown out the administrators of the what's called Environment Canterbury, the regional agency, so like an ABAG or an MTC. So they'd thrown them out, put in federal-appointed or national-appointed representatives just before the earthquakes happened. And so they said, well, there's no way we can turn this over to Environment Canterbury to lead, and we can't turn it over to Christchurch because Christchurch doesn't play well with any of the cities in the region. And so they created this thing called the Canterbury Earthquake Recovery, which is essentially becoming a whole nother level of government. It works sort of as a regional agency, but it's very nationalized. It has direct access to all the ministries. And it is effectively taking away the ability of the city to control any of its future land use, you know, pattern choices, thinking about its tax base. It's forcing the city to sell off assets to finance its recovery. So the city owned its airport, it owned its stadium, it owned several large assets that most cities in New Zealand don't own. They're now being forced to sell those off to finance their portion of this recovery. And all of that decision is being imposed on them. So it is kind of funny from the SAS point of view.
So it sounds like the city's ability to play together well as a region helps build trust with the feds.
Absolutely.
That's arguably a perfect segue to next steps.
Yeah.
If there aren't any other quick questions, so in terms of next steps, and I'll turn it over to the two of you to talk about this particular piece. I just want to mention there is a regional resilience initiative, as I described before, that ABAG has been involved with for a few years now. There have been a whole series of workshops held in conjunction with the regional planning committee at ABAG, a number of other work products. There's a gap analysis currently underway looking at a range of topics and where the region is at. And it's directed toward what Lori just described. And it does not have a conclusion at this point in time, but the general thinking behind the effort is that the more the Bay Area is coordinated and has its act together around this issue, the better positioned the region is going to be post-event to say, this is what we want to do, and to stand to the extent possible with one voice when whatever part of the region is particularly impacted. You know, if the East Bay is heavily impacted, it will be much more powerful if North Bay elected officials and Peninsula elected officials and those from San Francisco and the South Bay can say, we stand with the East Bay in terms of its approach to how to move forward. and we really would prefer not that these decisions are made in Sacramento or D.C., but they're made here, arguably that's a very good outcome. And you could switch the geographies depending upon how things play out. Toward that end, there is an event coming up in October, a date to be determined, but all of the Regional Advisory Working Group members will be invited and encouraged to attend to look at issues of governance and decision-making and to try to build this effort moving forward. And the ABAG effort, as described, is being linked with the SPUR effort, and among other things is really trying to build upon the much more detailed work that has been done in the city of San Francisco and how to use that as sort of best practices and a model for other jurisdictions in the region. Lori or Sarah, if you want to speak to sort of what the next steps in this project are. I know there's an intent to bring it back to the ROG at some point.
Yeah, so where we are in our process is that we're developing our concept ideas, and we're actually in the process of outlining. And so when we come back to you, we'd love to have much firmer outlines and then be in the process of sort of early drafting. And so so we'll look for this body to get some additional feedback. We've presented to you a framework for thinking about the issue, but we're going to be putting more meat on this bones, bringing it back to you in September. And then at the October workshop, we haven't yet fully figured out how it will work, but we'll be participating in that workshop and probably doing a breakout session focused specifically on land use planning issues. After that, we'll be more deeply in drafting. Hopefully by October we'll have draft recommendations for everybody to review, and then we'll have our draft done in, I guess, in November or so, and we'll be completing the project, a final version of the project in January. So those are some of the next steps. Does that answer the question?
Yes, absolutely.
Daniel, do you want to just provide any more information in terms of the resilience initiative at this point?
I don't think I have a lot to add. We are also working on a paper that's going to look at some of this kind of regional coordination decision-making issues. And there'll be that'll be kind of a white paper, gaps analysis and needs, and we'll identify some actions as well that we may recommend directed towards cities as well as the region. And we'll be doing a couple of issue papers around housing and business, infrastructure, and goods and services. And we're kind of on the same timeline as Sarah, as she mentioned. We have the same funding source for these two projects. So they're kind of working in parallel right now, and we'll be doing the workshop jointly in October. And we'll be inviting all of you to attend that.
Great. Thank you. I'll just mentioned just to bring folks up to date on topic very much directly related to the development of the plan. You're probably aware that the scoping session for the environmental impact report has been moving forward over the last several weeks. We had hoped to have the EIR on the agenda for today's meeting. However, dealing with the level of information obtained through the scoping sessions, input from stakeholders, particularly the social equity groups and the business community, as well as staff trying to sort out model versus off-model approaches to the EIR, which kept people fairly busy through the weekend, we now have a staff report moving forward that's been released. It's actually going to be presented in this room at 1 o'clock if you feel like hanging around or coming back to the Regional Planning Committee with five alternatives, including the project, the Jobs Housing Connection Strategy, and the Preferred Transportation Strategies, which were adopted in May, no project, and then three other alternatives. That will also be presented to the Joint MTC Planning ABIC Administrative Committee meeting on Friday here at 9:30, and then next Thursday, the 19th, in the evening at the Scottish Rite Temple here in Oakland, we're going to have another really big show. The full commission and executive board will be meeting to give staff direction to proceed on the environmental impact report, which is due in draft form near the very end of this calendar year, as well as adoption of the final methodology for the regional housing need allocation and adoption of what are essentially a modification, some new areas to be recognized in the plan called employment investment areas, as well as rural community investment areas. They were originally proposed as priority development areas. They are now not proposed as priority development areas. They're sort of a modification of that. So those pieces will be moving forward next week. So stay tuned. Hope to see some of you there. Nathan, you look like you had a question. No? Okay.
What time?
I'm sorry. That's at 7 p.m. in the evening. It should be very interesting. I think there'll be a lot of people there, I'm sure. Well, thank you very much. Thanks all for coming.
Thank you very much for your input.